Our final presentation is from William Tong. William is from the Cancer Control Program at the Lombardi Cancer Center at Georgetown. And his presentation is Interest in Single Nucleotide Polymorphism Genetic Testing for Colon Cancer Risk in Primary Care Patients.
That looks cool.
It is.
All right, thanks so much for having me. And just to preface this presentation, I have a bad cough today, as you've heard, so I might cough during this presentation. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. So many of you have probably heard of personalized medicine and genomic medicine media. In 2007, Science Magazine called human genetic variation as a breakthrough of the year. And in 2008, Time Magazine called the retail DNA test one of the best inventions of 2008. So most of what retail DNA testing companies offer is called SNP testing, and that looks for an individual's risk for certain diseases, and that's something that I'm going to focus on today. So humans are more than 99% similar. Most of what accounts for the differences in our DNA is called SNPs. So that stands for single nucleotide polymorphism. It's the most common type of genetic change observed in our DNA. A SNP is a single letter variation that occurs in the sequences of our DNA. So it's when an A, T, C, or G is altered in the normal type of sequence. So here's a visual for those who are more visually inclined. So on top you have the normal or wild type sequence, where a C is connected or bonded to a G. A SNP would be if that C is converted to a T, which is subsequently bonded to an A. A little bit more background on SNPs. For a SNP to be considered a SNP, it must occur in 1% of the population. And also, although over 1.5 million SNPs have been identified, we suspect that there might be 30 million or more. Many SNP tests have questionable clinical utility, although a few actually can guide an individual's care. An example would be genetic testing for a mutation on the F5 gene that causes a condition called factor V Leiden, which increases an individual's risk for blood clotting. So in the clinical context, a woman who tests positive for factor V Leiden would be suggested to discontinue hormonal birth control because her risk for blood clotting is further increased. It's important to note that SNPs do not directly cause cancer, and SNPs may be related to increased or decreased risk for cancer. So that what that means is that a person who inherits a SNP that increases risk may never develop the disease in her lifetime. On the other hand, the opposite is true. So a person who inherits a decreased risk may, in fact, develop the disease later in his or her life. SNPs associated with a variety of cancers have been identified. And cancer risk due to SNPs is heavily complicated by gene-gene interactions. So if you have two SNPs that increase your risk, are they additive or are they multiplicative? We just don't know. And also, these risks is complicated by gene-environment interactions. So how does your diet or your lifestyle and behaviors impact your overall risk? To put the level of risk conveyed by SNPs in context, I just want to contrast it with very rare hereditary cancer syndromes. They significantly increase your risk, but as I said before, they're very rare. Examples are HNPCC for colon cancer, and of course BRCA1 and BRCA2 for ovarian and breast cancer hereditary syndromes. So for those who are more visual inclined again, the first arrow points to average risk for colon cancer. The second arrow points to your risk if you had a SNP that increased your risk, so slightly higher. I just want to emphasize that if you're able to identify one close family member with colon cancer, it tells you about the same information as having a SNP test. And just to contrast everything, that's the level of risk if you do, in fact, have a hereditary cancer syndrome, so very different. So SNP genetic testing is not currently is not currently available as a typical clinical service. However, direct-to-consumer marketing for SNP testing related to health outcomes has already begun. So I'd just like to take a few minutes to describe some of the current DTC service, direct-to-consumer services available to consumers. There are many online companies that offer genetic testing, but one of the most popular ones can arguably be 23andMe. So the way it works is that you basically spit in a tube, you send it to the companies, they analyze your genetic sample, and they give you your results through the internet. Health traits and conditions are separated into two types of reports. Clinical reports are genetic associations that are built on more large, multi-peer-reviewed studies. You could find something out as trivial as earwax type. On the other hand, you could find out something more serious like VTE that's related to factor V lead-in that I explained earlier. The second type of report is a research report, which is based on less support in terms of scientific literature. Here you'll find colorectal cancer and also a variety of other types of cancers. So we don't know how many people are actually opting for such testing currently. However, regardless of its popularity, we want to know how to best inform or best promote informed decision making in those who do opt for such testing. So the parent study really tries to answer three questions. Who is interested in SNP testing for cancer risk? What information is needed to promote such decisions or to promote informed decisions? And how do we educate people about SNP risk? And this presentation is basically going to focus on the first and third questions. This presentation is also mainly based upon focus group data. So participants were recruited from Georgetown University's internal medicine clinic. Audio tapes were transcribed in-house and coded with InVivo 9. We also emphasized mainly on colon cancer SNPs because colon cancer affects both men and women. There's great screening available for colon cancer. Also, there are behavioral and lifestyle factors that can affect risk. So every focus group that we conducted followed this basic structure. We had an overview of SNPs and genetic testing. Basically, the information that I provided with you this morning was in that part of the session. We also then conducted a pre-discussion survey. Then we had the risk communication session, and we solicited participant feedback. And then we had a post-discussion survey. So we had four focus groups with 24 participants. Most were women. Mean age was 54.3 years. A variety of ethnicities were present. And also, although we had four cancer survivors, they were not excluded from our study. These are the two main questions that we'll focus on today. The first is, how interested would you be in having a SNP test for a colon cancer gene change that increased your lifetime risk of developing the disease from 6% to 7.5%? And the other question is basically the same one, but for a decreased risk. And these are the questions that we asked the focus group participants. And it was a 5-point Likert scale that ranged from very interested to not at all interested. And then we had an option for people to say they were unsure. So in the pre-discussion survey, you can see that 54.2% of our participants were very interested in having a SNP test that showed an increased risk from 6% to 7%, and 8.3% were not at all interested. In a decreased risk, the SNP that conveyed a decreased risk, a smaller percentage of our focus group participants were interested, 33.3%, and more were not at all interested in this type of SNP. So here are some comments from our focus group participants, those who were interested in having the test. When it comes to genetic testing, I just like to know what to worry about and what not to worry about. And a comment that really exemplified a typical response to why a participant was interested in this type of testing is that they wanted to know than not to know. And for those who were not at all interested or skeptical of genetic testing, they didn't think that that 1.5% increase was very large. And another participant mentioned that if there are no elements of the disease that I can control, and if I needed to be checking on it anyways, does it really matter what the test shows? And in terms of the SNP that conveys a decreased risk, a participant mentioned that they couldn't think of any other reason to have that type of test unless it was just to help progress research. So here's a little bit more information about the risk communication session that we had with our participants. It was a 10 to 15 minute Q&A session with the genetic counselor that we had and the study principal investigator. Risk information was presented using text and images. And participant feedback was also solicited about those images, if they liked it, if they didn't, if they understood it or not. For the risk communication session, we focused on two SNPs. These are based on actual SNP data, but we renamed them as SNP A and SNP B for simplification purposes. So we told our participants that SNP A lowers your risk by about 18%. So it goes from 6% to 5%, and SNP B increases your risk by about 25%, so from 6% to 7.5%. And although 18% and 25% sound large, they're not large enough to actually affect any clinical guidelines. And to calculate that, you take 18% of 6, which is 1%, and that's how the math goes. So this is a graphical representation of the information that I just provided, and we also showed this to our focus group participants. The graphic on the left shows your average lifetime risk for colon cancer. The middle panel shows if you had SNP A, which decreases your risk. And the last graphic is of SNP B, which increases your risk. We also had written descriptions. I'm sorry it says verbal, but it was written descriptions of SNP risk. And what we really tried to convey was that SNPs don't really increase or decrease your risk by very much. And we really wanted to hit that point home and to see how that would affect an individual's interest in having these SNP tests. However, as you can see, interest in having a SNP test that conveyed an increased risk did not change. It was still 54.2%. And it did not change for those who are not at all interested too, so 8.3% were still not at all interested. Same story here, 33.3% were still very interested in having a SNP test that decreased risk, although those who are not at all interested did increase by a little. So it's important to say that we ran a paired samples t-test, and the means of interest was not significantly different before and after the risk communication session. This may simply reflect the difficulty of educating individuals about SNP risk, the difficulty of understanding SNP risk, or a combination of both. Interest in SNP testing was related to affective status. So those who were cancer survivors were less interested in having a SNP test. However, interest was not significant related to any other demographic or family history of cancer. So major themes did occur in our focus groups. Concerns about privacy of SNP results, impact on insurance coverage and eligibility, and preferences for SNP information to be conveyed by an actual human being. So they didn't want it from a computer interface or through a kiosk or over the telephone. They rather have had it through a physician or a genetic counselor or a nurse. So it may seem premature to explore informed decision-making in SNP testing at this point, but it's important to lay the groundwork and to improve upon pre-test educational materials in the event that SNP testing does become a more popular and more widely used technology in the future. And clinicians must be prepared to discuss genetic test results with their patients if they do, in fact, are shown to be clinically significant, and perhaps more importantly, if they're proved to be shown to be clinically insignificant. Of course, there are limitations to this study with a small sample size, 24 participants in a focus group, and it was primarily qualitative data. Because interest in SNP testing was so high, we applied for an RO supplement. So we're actually going to offer SNP testing to see actual uptake in 50 primary care patients. And it's gonna be a mostly qualitative type of study. So we'll provide them with pre-test education and also in-depth interviewing. And this is basically just to see how patients think of the SNP testing type of process and to improve upon pre-test education materials. So I just want to thank my collaborators and any questions? I would say no. Some did have knowledge of BRCA1, BRCA2 testing, but not SNP testing, and that's what the overview was for, just to get them situated about what SNPs are. But I'd say that most of them did not have any prior knowledge of SNP testing before the focus group. I think you first.
What about the cost issue?
Exactly. We did ask them that question as well. Most people would expect it to be covered by health insurance, which obviously it's not currently. And that is also one of the limitations in their interest, because cost wasn't factored in. In the current randomized survey that we're currently conducting, it's scenario-based items, so interest will vary upon. So the scenarios ask if you're interested in a test, if it's $50 or if it's $100, and I'm sure interest will decrease due to cost of testing.
Sorry.
So there are a series of four SNPs that are currently offered by these DTC companies. I don't remember the name of them, but the ones that are offered by these, yes, yeah, we'll be offering them four. We'll be collecting them in-house and running them in our own facilities. So they won't be going through these online companies.
And there won't be any cost to them.
No. So let's see how that affects interest.
If I could just ask all of our presenters to come out, we have about 10 or 15 minutes for a giant.
No, I really think it depends on the individual. Some individuals are adopted, so they don't have the opportunity to look at their family tree and see if their relatives have a certain disease. So obviously, for a certain individuals, genetic testing might be more of a resource that they could look into. But you could chime in about that.
Well, I mean, I think for both, the caveat is there's research on what it means for individuals and what are the primary courses of action in the primary care setting. But the one thing that I would say is there is a very a larger body of evidence and kind of anecdotal evidence as well around family health history benefiting not just for prediction of disease and diagnosis, certainly for rare conditions, single gene disorders, but also for improving conversations in families and kind of as an educational model as well. So there, whereas genetic testing is very focused, family health history is a more broader suite of concepts.
It's interesting because you know, when you talk to individuals who've been tested, they're found to be positive for a disorder that may affect their insurability, there will inevitably be some family members who want to keep that information private and to themselves. So the discussion potential for the different means of assessment that may have been there.
And both family health history and predicted genetic testing results are covered by the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, but that is just kind of a baseline protection. So obviously, more rules to that.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add is just, what I think we haven't quite focused on as a community is this idea of primary prevention versus, say, secondary prevention. I think that we often talk about these genetic testing versus family history, and it seems very limited to this, like, what will you take into the doctor's office to help either develop strategies for reducing risk or I had a genetic test for a clotting disorder, and it seems to me there are very different applications, and so answering that question, I think, really depends on, do you want people to take steps to mitigate their risk, or are you looking for a different type of clinical application?
I just wanted to follow up something that William, you said. So you said about 54% of your focus group participants were interested in receiving the SNP test. And I think what you said was after the risk communication session, those numbers didn't change, so even after being informed what that really meant, that 54% or roughly were still interested in receiving the test.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious what you thought about that. So providing better educational materials, would that really change? Is that just something about our nature that some of us are interested in learning this information, even if we know that it's not going to do much?
We did ask our participants that after the fact. I think most of what it came down to is these participants really wanted to know everything, every little thing about their health. And since cost wasn't really necessarily a factor in that, like the lady mentioned, I think hypothetically a lot of people would just still be interested in it. Obviously, there's always going to be a discrepancy between interest and uptake. So it'll be interesting to see what the RS supplement shows us in terms of after the fact, if they'll be interested in such testing.
I think it's really interesting too because there's different kind of barriers. Cost is certainly a barrier with testing where it's not the family health history, but family health history, there are other barriers, like the difficulty of talking to family members about health. So certainly there are different barriers as well that keep people from doing these different types of information. You can keep genetic testing private, but by definition, family health history requires you to talk to your family, and that's sometimes a very hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You said you look at individuals'
So we did look to see if family history had any impact on interest, and there wasn't.
I kind of wondered if people talk at all about BRCA1 and 2 testing, and if their knowledge of that somehow biased what they thought about SNP testing. You know, like, does that make them, because they about this other test, then does that make them say, oh, of course I want that test?
I'm sure. In terms of our society and our culture is so gung-ho about any type of diagnostic test that could tell us more about how we're doing in terms of our health, I'm sure that had something to do with it. But they didn't specifically say this might be something like BRCA1 or BRCA2 testing, and so unfortunately that didn't come up.
I guess I could add something to that. My concern about someone looking at this, and I keep harping on this like clinical context, but one of the studies we manage that we're a part of is the REVEAL study. So we offer people genetic susceptibility testing for APOE testing for Alzheimer's disease risk, giving them a risk assessment based on whether they have an E4 allele or not, and then see what they do with the information. What we see in a lot of our participants is they look at this kind of genetic testing as an alternative to going in and talking to a doctor. They don't want to share this information with physicians. They don't want to. They look at it as something very private and something that they can do. That's an alternative to talking to a physician. And so when we start to look at, like, we look at 23andMe and make assumptions about their business model, well, they throw things like earwax on there because they're framing this in a much different way than manage your health. That you see a lot of these services and they're getting framed as more like know about yourself. And so I think we need to be careful about this clinical context.
Just a small comment. The other day I drew up a web item about 23andMe, and the paradox about the company is, yes, they're interested in telling people about all these traits, many of them distant from health issues, but they've got a huge clientele, you know, so they've got a huge population base now, which if the proper connections were developed could have health relevance if they think with investigators. So it's sort of an untapped resource in that sense.
They have a huge base. It's interesting when you compare 23andMe and they don't mandate conversations with genetic counselors, and you compare them to, say, like a Navigenics model where you know they very strongly promote interacting with the genetic counselor, and you have a very different customer base of these two companies, both age and how what they expect to do with their information. Navigenics tends to get an older, worried well, and 23andMe tends to get the younger, like, hey, this is sort of social, this is an extension of social networking and sharing, information sharing. So, yes, I think that I think we're just at the forefront of figuring out how we can use these things as tools based on how they approach the tests in the first place to promote health. So, but we're a long way. You start talking about behavior and the bazillion things that affect whether or not somebody will eat better. I think we've only started to brush our fingernails against.
Maybe curling the tongue.
Yes.
Marketing dollars associated with educating people.
Any last questions? Otherwise, let's thank everyone again.